You're listening to OU Podcasts.
Hey guys, welcome to Operation Ultra. I'm Dustin.
And this is Rachel.
And this is the nice round number episode 20. And we've got another great episode lined up for you today. Two folks, I think they have great stories overall. First, we've got Andy Jones-Wilkins. So if you've been around Ultra Running a while, you've heard of Andy Jones-Wilkins, and you've probably read something he's written on I Run Far. But much like Dr. David Horton, Andy Jones-Wilkins has been there, done that in the world of Ultra Running, has tons of experience and has run all kinds of races out there, most of the big ones, and been at the top. So it's interesting to get to talk to him and kind of hear more of his story and how he got started. And he's actually fresh off of his sub-24-hour finish for his Hard Rock qualifier at Grindstone this year. So I think we'll enjoy that.
And then we'll be touching base with Rob Goyen, who's the founder of Houston Area Trail Runners and also the race director for the newly established Brazos Bend 100 in Texas. And Rob's got a very interesting backstory of what got him involved in ultra running. I think his story is very inspiring, and we really enjoy getting to talk to him.
But first, let's go to Andy Jones-Wilkins, and we get to hear some of his experience about being an East Coast ultra runner but dominating in West Coast races, his final Western States this year, and running with his son. Andy, you just are coming off what I consider probably one of the greatest accomplishments an ultra runner could have, not only finishing this year's Western States in a great time, but getting that 10 finish buckle, the 10 finishes under 24 hours. How does that feel for you?
To tell you the truth, it's probably the most satisfying accomplishment of my life. I've had other great things in my life. I have a wonderful family and a great job and so forth. But, you know, I set that goal, I think I said, kind of set it quietly to myself after I finished five. And the fact that I admire all the others who've done 10 just made it all the more desirable for me. So it was a huge feeling of accomplishment, especially coming off a couple of years of up and downs with injuries and coming to grips with the fact that I wasn't quite as competitive as I was in the days of say my third, fourth, and fifth finishes. It took a little mental adjustment, but you know, to do something consistently like that for over a decade really gives me tremendous satisfaction.
You have at least 10 Western State buckles, and not to mention all your other buckles. So what do you do with your buckles? Are they on display somewhere, or are they tucked in a drawer?
I should put them on display. I do have a room in my house that someday will probably have some things on the wall, but most of them are in a box. I did this year, though, on the Monday after Western States, my family and I drove over to Reno, and we went to a good old-fashioned cowboy leather store and bought a belt, an unfinished belt, just raw leather with some carvings of Western mountain animals on it and so forth. And I got the dye to dye it and the sheen to finish it. So I actually have a legitimate belt now, and I can wear my buckles with that. So I do, I've been wearing my 10-day buckle, perhaps a bit more often than most people are used to seeing me walk around Charlottesville.
Yeah, first of all, in context, probably most of the folks you meet around Charlottesville may not be familiar with the race, but I think if I were in your position, I don't know if I'd ever take it off.
Exactly.
You obviously feel a special draw to Western States. You've run Western States, a lot, obviously. So what is the draw out to the West Coast, especially being an East Coaster like you are?
Well, when I first moved, I grew up in New York and worked in Philadelphia for quite a few years, and that's where I met my wife. But we ended up out west, and we actually bounced around to three different Western towns over 15 years before moving back here. And it was where I discovered trail running. Particularly the 5 years I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, you can't really go very far without running into ultra runners. And if you run into ultra runners in the Bay Area, they invariably talk about Western states. So that's how I, you know, kind of started my love affair with Western states. But I also should say, I was born in Massachusetts and did feel after my first Western States, which was to me, at least from my perspective, a subpar performance. I got a silver buckle. This was back in 2001. I got a silver buckle and felt good about that, but really, really wasn't satisfied with my race. The last 6-7 hours were just really, really bad. And I made all the rookie mistakes. My headlamp battery went out. I ran out of food. I wasn't taking calories. I wasn't communicating well with my pacer. So I set a goal for myself at that point to not come back, not even attempt to come back to Western States until I'd mastered how to run 100 miles. And in fact, I did that at the Vermont 100 in 2002, 2003. So I now have 4 Vermont finishes. I'd like to go back there and run a little bit better times than I have, although I won that race twice. That's kind of terrain really plays into my strength, the blend of roads and trails and a lot of ups and downs, but not too many super long ups and downs. That's the story of the Western States love affair. You know, moving forward, I'm actually not wasting much time. I'm going to run Grindstone 100, which is here in Virginia, in central Virginia, in early October. And, you know, got my eyes on the Virginia series of races that David Horton and Clark Zeelan run, because they're just, you know, you don't have to go very far from Charlottesville to have a race to do at least every month, if not more often than that.
Yeah, and I know David puts on nice, easy trail runs too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you feel that training where you are currently, are you able to get the elevation change, the hill running to feel like you can adequately prepare for those West Coast races where the climbs are probably a good bit longer and more sustained?
I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about the East and that there are no long sustained climbs. You have to know where to look. I'm of the opinion that now that I've lived here 3 years and kind of grew up out here, if you know where to go, and with the exception of actual altitude, obviously with the highest points around here being 5,000-6,000 feet, you're not going to be able to get acclimated to Leadville and Hard Rock that way. But, you know, just within an hour of my house, the Priest and Three Ridges area of the Appalachian Trail has always been a hotbed training ground for people training for Western hundreds. You can pack in 7,500 feet of climbing there in 19 miles. The White Oak Trail, which is in the west of the Shenandoah Valley, has a beautiful 25-mile loop that I did a couple weeks ago with over 7,400 feet of climbing and some real grindy climbs. This one climb took us, it was a 7-miler, went about 3,800 feet. It had some level places, but my feeling is if you know where to go, and I mean, granted, if you live in Virginia Beach, you have to drive a little ways. In western North Carolina and east Tennessee and north Georgia, some places in the Ozarks and Arkansas, if you know where to look, you can find some long sustained climbs that set you up for just about anything the West can throw at you.
You're right. In terms of elevation change, absolutely. You know, it's hard to mimic the altitude, but hey, we've got those hot, humid summers to do that, or at least as close as possible do that.
And in addition to that, I will say that the East Coast trails will test anybody's ability to run on technical stuff. The rocks, the routes, the varied terrain, the fact that a lot of these trails were built before they were engineered to create switchbacks. It is a grind up here, and I think when, you know, sometimes those West Coasters are a little bit spoiled by their nicely manicured trails, but out here, you know, you earn your miles on some of these rugged trails.
Yeah, we Rachel and I were out this past weekend on one of our favorite trails to run around here, and we had a good number of run-ins with what we call babyhead rocks, where you've got to be watching about a foot in front of you, or you're going to go down.
Absolutely, you really do, and you know you could be clipping along at something that's pretty mellow grade, and you'd be lucky to go 12 minute miles because of the trail surface.
Absolutely. So do you think maybe the difficulty in the technical trails and the climbing on the rocks helps maybe pick things up a little bit better when you have the smoother grade to run on?
Yeah, not only does it help, but it's the mental training is there. You know, if you spend 2 hours picking your way through rocks and roots and pretty gnarly trail, and then you find yourself out on something smooth, you're just immediately going to get a burst of adrenaline and just enjoy it. And so, for example, being out of Western States this year, I just felt a certain amount of freedom on the smooth single track that characterizes a lot of that course, because I'd run on some pretty gnarly stuff back here. In fact, I needed to seek out training routes here that were relatively tame so that I would actually get used to running on some smoother trails, which I was going to face out in the West Coast. So it was an interesting dichotomy for me training. But I would say to anybody in the East interested in running something in the West, you know, if you can just get the big vertical, and you get out in the hot and the humidity and the other trying circumstances, aside from having to figure out altitude, you're going to be all set.
So back to Western States this year, I know maybe your time, you were at 1921. I know that may not necessarily be on par with some of your prior year finishes, but how did you feel about that? I mean, compared to your training, did you kind of finish where you expected? And I guess tell us a little bit about how your race went.
I will say, yes, I finished where I expected. I was 4 minutes faster than I was last year. I felt as though I was in a little bit better shape than last year. Last year was a lot hotter. This is 2013. You know, the difference for me this year was certainly the emotion of the day. And for the first 50 miles, I really I was just savoring being out there, knowing it was going to be my last time out there. And running with friends, I had a good 20-mile section to run with Nikki Kimball, who I've known for a decade, and she was finishing her ninth this year. Ran through the canyons with some friends, and actually felt strangely low on energy by the time I got to mile 55. While it wasn't very hot, it was unusually dry. I mean, it's always dry out there, but it was unusually dry. And I think that had some kind of effect on my energy. I ran real solid once I got through that little downturn. So from mile 55 to mile 62, where I picked up my first pacer, did a really solid split through there, and then the first 8 miles of the California Street section, which takes you down to the American River, went well. But then, as has happened to me, you know, more or less 50% of the time in my 100-mile races, my stomach turned on me. I had a rather violent puking episode at mile 70. Had another one at 80. And so for the rest of the day, I was really needing to manage my energy and my pace. And so I kind of pulled it back at that point. I didn't want the wheels to completely fall off, and I was reduced to pretty much drinking Sprite and just a little bit of gels here and there. So I had to run those last 5 hours completely on fumes. The good thing is, you know, as it was my 30th 100-mile finish, I'm used to running on fumes, but I also know that there's only so fast I can go. You know, I initially thought, given how the weather was going to be somewhat benign, that I could maybe do sub 19 or even an 18:45 or something like that based on my training. But, you know, all in all, I was satisfied. And now 5 weeks later, I'm even more satisfied, because I think because of my stomach issues and having to slow down my pace, I didn't trash myself in the last 30 miles, and my recovery has been great. I'm back up to 50 miles a week, and as I said, getting ready to run Grindstone. So maybe a blessing in disguise.
Having those stomach issues like that, that's something I can relate to. I'm about 50% on my ultras having my stomach turned south. Is that something that you've just taken as that's just part of the ultra experience? Or can you identify a trigger? And is there anything that you've found that really can help you recover from those stomach issues to continue on?
Yeah, you know, I wish I knew. The stomach is a real mystery. And I've tried to pin down, okay, maybe it's altitude, or maybe it's heat, or maybe it's, that I've imbalanced calories or too much at once. And the truth is, of my 15 issues, 15 times I've had issues, I haven't been able to find one factor. I'd say the only common factor is the time in the race. It typically happens to me after 12 hours, maybe even after 14 hours. If I can make it through, say, to 18 or 19 hours, I'm usually scot-free. But I can't really pinpoint any one factor. I've had hot years where I've gotten sick. I've had cold years where I've gotten sick. I've had altitude races that I've gotten sick and altitude races where I've had no problem. Flat stuff like Rocky Raccoon, some years have been good, some years not so good. So I can't really point to circumstances. In terms of what has worked, I mean, definitely I'm an adherent to solid food as long as I can take it. So in a case of, say, Western states, I will try to be getting solid food down. And by that, I mean turkey and cheese and avocado sandwiches, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, cookies, fruit, if it works for me, potatoes with salt, all the way through about mile 62. I'll be taking other calories as well, and I know everybody's different on this, but then when I get to the point where it's like, okay, I can't have another piece of solid food, then I switch over to gels and Cliff and blocks and those sorts of things. And then I don't have to take them quite as much, and they don't quite make me, I don't get sick of them, you know, tired of taking, oh my God, another gel. The other thing I think that's true is if you, run too fast, and don't let your system digest the food, don't let your system process the fluids, don't let your body kind of get to a place of homeostasis with the calories and the fluids and the salt that you're taking in. You've got to try and find that balance. And each day, it seems like for me, the balance is a little bit different. So I have sat down with my wife after these races and tried to figure out, okay, why today did I not have any stomach issues? And why last year did the wheels completely fall off? And I have to say, it's still a mystery, but it's also one of the great things to try and figure out, because, it's one of those challenges that it takes down even the most fit people, out there on the trail. And I guess that makes it the great equalizer.
Well, and that's what is heartening to me is that, you know, I'm 2 for 3 in my 100-mile attempts. So I'm still relatively new at the distance and at ultra running, only been doing it a handful of years. But even someone who has the experience that you do, if you're still figuring out, I feel okay now that I don't necessarily know what I'm doing.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. The difference, I suppose, between a person with 3 and a person with 30 is I've experienced almost everything out there. And the three biggest things that bring down a lot of runners in hundreds and make them drop out are, you know, issues with their feet, issues with their quads, and issues with their stomach. You know, other things will happen that could be more traumatic, whether it's kidney failure or, you know, broken bones or, you know, falling on your head or acute pulmonary edema or, you know, any of those things. And those could obviously, they are life-threatening. You got to be careful. But, you know, blisters and quad problems and stomach issues are not life-threatening. They are morale-threatening for sure, and they certainly, you know, can make you really, really grumpy. And so when you have a lot of experience getting through that, you know, I've done it 30 times, you kind of, it's a little bit of been there, done that. It's like, all right, my quads are shot. It means I'm not going to be able to hammer the downhills as much, so I might as well climb as aggressively as I can to make up time there. Or, oh my God, my feet are blistering up. Maybe I will use the 5 minutes at this next aid station and change socks and put tape on my feet. And, you know, it's going to affect my overall time, but it's also going to make the likelihood of a finish much higher. So there's no substitute for experience in solving the problems that inevitably come for 100 milers. The best part is, it's really the test of the kind of person you are in how you solve those problems and deal with them and, you know, fight through to the other side.
Well, and that brings up a good point. I know you've had some issues in the past. Was it a renal failure issue or renal issues at Angeles Crest?
Yeah, in Angeles Crest in 2004.
So how do you know where that line is of pushing through smartly or maybe pushing when it's time to go to the hospital?
Yeah, that was a real wake-up call, frankly. You know, at that point, I was probably 7-8 years into ultra-running career. I was probably, I think it might have been my 5th or 600, and I was racing to win. So, you know, like a lot of the guys out there, these past couple of years, it was hot and heavy out up at the front of the pack, and I was kind of throwing caution to the wind on those last 10 miles of Angeles Crest that year. Just, I was in second place. I was trying to chase down the leader. I never did catch him, but the damage I did to my muscles was so severe that I ended up getting rhabdomyolysis and had 6 days in the hospital. My kidneys are fine now, but even to this day, I get tested. I get my kidney function tested, typically the Monday or Tuesday after a 100 miler, just to make sure my numbers are within range. What I did wrong then, and haven't done wrong since, is I attempted to push my body beyond the limits of my training. I'll never forget the doctor, a kidney doctor who I met with when the dust had settled on this. It was maybe a couple months after, and I said, hey, look, I want to keep running these things, but, you know, I've got a wife and family, and I don't want to die out there. You know, what can I do? And he said, well, there's two things you can do. When you feel that acute pain, and you know the difference between, you know, just a big, dull ache and absolutely stabbing pain. I mean, it literally felt like I had railroad stakes jammed into my quads. He said, you have to slow down. You have to get hydrated. You have to even walk a little bit. He said, you could do that. Or the second thing you could do is to just train harder, but for shorter bouts, and try to mitigate against that kind of pain ever happening. And ultimately, that's what I ended up doing. And as a result, you know, in the prime of my career, which was from 2005 to 2010, I trained harder than I ever had in my life and was able to hold any of those kinds of issues at bay. To the extent where now, as I'm in kind of the waning years, at least I'm not in a competitive place anymore, I also realize that I can get by on a lot less. You know, I can get by, I can run a 100 miler on 70 miles a week, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I probably needed to run 100 miles a week to successfully manage a 100 miler. You just have to, you really do, I know it's cliche, but you really do have to listen to your body and all the signals it tells you. Ultimately, if you're in danger of something like renal failure, your body's going to tell you either by weight gain or discolored urine or other factors that you're going to have to listen to.
With this Western States this year, are you planning on going back? Are you going to go out on top?
10 times is a lot. And with an event that is so much in demand, that has, you know, several thousand people applying for the precious spots, you know, I've had my turn out there, and I plan to return as a volunteer. I'm close friends with the race director, and I'd love to work an aid station. I'd love to be part of the finish line festivities. I had fun this year when John Mettinger, who's the race finish line announcer, asked me to fill in for a couple of hours so he could get a little nap. That was fun. I enjoyed doing that. So I'll remain a part of the Western States experience, but I also have a whole lot of other races I'd like to do. We've talked about the other East Coast races. I'd like to do Old Dominion, which is one of the classic one of the original hundreds here in Shenandoah County in the beginning of June. There's a new race down, you might have heard of it, down in Tennessee called Thunder Rock that looks really gnarly and tough.
Absolutely. And if I've mentioned on the podcast, sadly, a couple of times now that I'm committed to that next year.
Oh, all right. Good. Well, a good friend of mine who's a fellow runner on my ultra running team, Rock Horton, came out to run it this past April, and he just raved about it, and he said it was really good. So you know, there's a lot that I want to do. I'm going to keep running, but there's a nice neat closure to the 10 finishes that feels good. You know what else I've gotten a kick out of doing? I think I'll increase it. Is I've got a small little group of runners over the past few years that I've coached, and just, you know, very inexpensively and mostly online. But just coached for about 5 months leading up to Western States, kind of because I know the course so well and what they're going to be up against, and the fact that many people who get into Western States realize it might be a once in a lifetime opportunity. You know, it's been really fun. So like this year, we coached four guys, and three of them finished. All had really good times under 24 hours. The fourth one didn't quite make the cutoffs, but he's going to come back. So I mean, that's the kind of stuff I like to do, and it'll always keep me connected to the event.
You mentioned a number of other races. You mentioned you're doing Grindstone. Is that did I read that that's going to be your Hard Rock qualifier?
That is, yeah. As you know, Western States is being phased out as a Hard Rock qualifier, which I think is wise. They're very, very different races. And so Hard Rock has selected, it's a rather small number, it might not even be 20, 100-mile races across the country and a few in international that are qualifiers. And Grindstone, at least as of now, is the only East Coast Hard Rock qualifier. So, yeah, if I can get through that, which I hope to do, then I'll be in line for a Hard Rock qualifier, because I went to Hard Rock once in 2009. And I said, boy, I'd love to go back there when I'm on fresh legs, when I haven't run Western States a couple weeks before. So, of course, they have a lottery, and it sometimes takes a few years to get in. But if there's one thing ultra running has taught me, it's patience. So I'll be patient.
Maybe as you get older and more experienced, do you see more of a draw to a course like or a race like Hard Rock than Western States?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. For me, as I get older, the more mountainous courses, Grindstone as well, the more mountainous courses with a lot of power hiking, and a lot, maybe even route finding, I think I will enjoy much more success in those kind of races. I wouldn't mind even going back to Wasatch that I ran Wasatch twice and paced there twice, but that's also another kind of good old guys course, where you know, experience matters and big, long stretches of power hiking. I like that stuff.
Are we to anticipate then that Barkley might be on your list someday?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been meaning to get down there to take in the scene. My friend Craig Thornley, as I mentioned earlier, he came out a year ago to crew Alan and Bev Abbs, who are friends from the West, and he really took in the environment. I'd like to go down and take in the environment first and get to know things. But yeah, I could see Barkley in my future. That's a big undertaking, but it might be fun.
I don't know if I'd classify it as fun, but that'd be fun. It'd be fun for me to see you go out there and give it a shot on the course there. So in reading through your, we all, of course, like everybody does, we have to stalk your ultra sign up results page. and it reads like an honor roll of the best races out there. So, If you had to pick a favorite other than Western States, because we know Western States would be at the top, is there a race or two that really stands out as a gem or one you'd recommend to others?
Well, yeah, I mean immediately what I'm going to say is Hard Rock, and like I said earlier, I've run it once. And it was 13 days after Western States, but just the beauty, the sheer beauty and majesty of the San Juan Mountains is overwhelming. And while going up over 13,000-14,000 feet is brutal, I would say, if you want to have something on your bucket list, that's a race to have on there. The second tier really has three, and they have three very different flavors, but they all have a soft spot in my heart. And those are, Angeles Crest out in Southern California, the Vermont 100 in, up in Woodstock, Vermont, and Wasatch. And I think that, the fact that I've done those three, plus Hard Rock and plus Western States, I like the feeling of that. What I like about those three, if you want to test a runner's, if you care about a runner's versatility, whether they can run dirt roads and trails, whether they can run long sustained climbs or short, ups and downs. Those three races collectively will test any runner. And, they're hard to get into like all the others, but at least they're not, as insanely hard to get into with lottery, wait lists and so forth. So, I would certainly put those on the list. And, and then frankly, and I've only talked about 100-mile races, but in the sub 100, less than 100-mile races, I have to put a plug in for the whole Virginia series, Clark Zeeland's races, Terrapin and Grindstone, David Horton's races, the three spring 50Ks of Holiday Lake and Promise are two, Holiday Lake and Promise, and then the 50-miler Mountain Masochist in November. I mean, these are just, they're well-organized, they're well-run, they're good fun. The Virginia people really come out in great force for them. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to be a part of.
There is a great selection of races out there.
Yeah, and you get to run on all surfaces. You get all times of year. The vibe is always fun. There's always camping at the start finish and those kind of things. And then, there are also some bucket list type, a sub 100 race, the Miwok 100K in California, Horton's Hellgate 100K, which starts at midnight. There's races with a whole lot of history. There's a road race that Gary Cantrell's keeping alive that I'd like to do one year called Strolling Jim.
Absolutely, that's really popular for runners from around here.
Absolutely, and so the beauty of the growth of ultra running is, while it's grown and some folks have gotten crowded out of some events, that there's always another event, and it's typically going to have cool people and a nice course and a good vibe. So that's one of the things I love most about the sport.
I also saw that when you raced in Western States last year, I'm not sure about this year, but you had your son pace you for the last handful of miles. I guess as maybe you're not focusing as much on the fast times at Western or things like that, is that the kind of experience you're really going for?
You hit it on the head. He did. He paced me last year, and then again this year. This is my 14-year-old son, Logan. I have three sons. Carson is 16, and he was pretty much the co-crew chief with my wife, and has been for years, and has his driver's license now, so he was able to help out with the driving and so on and so forth. In fact, Logan and Carson came out and were my crew at Highland Sky out in West Virginia, which I did as a final tune-up for Western States. And it was the first time I'd been crewed by my kids without their mother. She was at a lacrosse tournament with our other son, and so they came and crewed me, and it was just a blast. And everybody at the aid stations were looking at him and saying, "Wow, these kids know what they're doing when it comes to crewing." And I had to, Horton was there too, and he explained that they've been crewing since they were in diapers. But having Logan pace me the last 2 years, he paced about the last 7 miles each time. And granted, he's grown out of me. He's about an 18-minute, 17:30 5K runner now. So it wasn't much work for him to pace me. But just having him by my side, having him part of the experience, he's already said he'd like someday to run Western States. And spreading the love of ultra running to my family, to my friends, to my students here at my school, that's an important part of what I feel like I can continue to give to the sport.
And we can't have you on here without having you talk about the race that you direct, which is the Thomas Jefferson 100K, and it'll be next March, but I'm sure you're already knee deep in preparation for that. Tell us a little bit about what runners can expect to see this next year.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm actually quite proud of this little race that we hatched last year, the Thomas Jefferson 100K. I've got a great team of folks behind me, the local trail running shop, Crozet Running. John Anderson, who's the co-owner with his wife Michelle, is my co-race director. And I've got a great team. Sophie Spidell is the course marshal, and we had great sponsors and had a lot of fun with Monticello and playing up the kind of Thomas Jefferson theme. Everybody, the finishing award was a $2 bill, which has, of course, Thomas Jefferson on it. And I was a history teacher for years. And so the race itself, it's going into its second year. It's going to be March 14th, 2015. Takes place entirely in a county, Albemarle County Park. It's comprised of seven 8.9 mile loops. So it is a repetitive loop course. It's intentionally designed along the model of other iconic loop courses like Rocky Raccoon. I think you've done Rocky Raccoon. Is that right?
Yes, I have.
Like Rocky Raccoon and Umstead and Javelina. So it takes a certain type. As you know, it takes a certain kind of person to do a multiple loop course. But we believe it provides an outstanding race experience. Two full service aid stations you see repeatedly, a start finish line where you can set up on grass, you can set up your chair, you can lay out your stuff, you can, an incredible group of volunteers. It's all single track. The entire course is single track. It winds through the woods. The cumulative elevation gain over the 62 miles is just over 7,000 feet. And so last year in our inaugural running, we had 33 finishers. We had some folks right around 10 hours and then a couple who were just scraping the 18-hour cutoff, but they made it. It's just great. And it's been great for the local, especially the local Charlottesville running community, to have an event in the middle of March that's longer than say a 50K or a 50 mile that can give them some miles, some training miles if they're getting ready for say Massanutten, MMT 100, which is in May, or Old Dominion, which is in June, and can do it in a very controlled environment where they see their crew and all the time. So we're excited about the future of this thing. And I've always admired race directors and always had in my back of my mind that someday when the planets lined up, I would direct my own race. And so this is fulfilling that dream. We have the award ceremony here at my school. I'm the head of a small private school here in Charlottesville. So we have the pre-race briefing here and we have the a pre-race dinner and then a breakfast the next day. There's camping nearby where people can camp if they don't want to have the expense of a hotel. It's a nice little event. And then if they turn it into a vacation, there's all the history of Charlottesville. There's Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. There's UVA. There's a booming industry of wineries and breweries here. So great restaurants. So all in all, it's a good time, and we're proud of it after 1 year. And hope that it continues for many more.
What I like about that is I'm getting to train with my son for his first half marathon now and getting to have those shared experiences and something that he'll always remember. I don't know. It's that father-son time. It's kind of special for me.
Yeah, it's great to see those runners who have so much experience and just still have that passion for the sport that are willing to pass it along. And also, you know, interesting to hear in our interview how Andy still doesn't have it all figured out. You know, sometimes we feel like just because we're new at the sport, we fumble our way through it. But, you know, Andy's got 300-mile finishes under his belt, and he's still trying to figure out some of those stomach issues that plague him.
And to be done with Western States, that's kind of surprising to say that's it, to say no more to that. But, you know, he's been there enough. He's proven himself there. So I guess there is no need to go back. Well, now let's talk to Rob Goyen. Now, Rob has a great story of really literally becoming half the man he used to be, kind of battling his addiction to make healthier lifestyle choices and to come out a better person on the other end.
Most of us come into this fringe sport, I guess, for some reason. Not many people set out to say, hey, I want to go run 50 or more miles out in the middle of the woods in the middle of nowhere for no real good reason. Most of us have some inciting incident or something that kind of brings us in. And I think you kind of have that similar experience. So what really got you started in ultra running?
Well, I think it was a combination of, you know, getting healthy. That's how I found trail running, essentially. It's 2009, September is actually the anniversary of this for me next week. But, you know, I was a smoker and drinker, and I was about 350 pounds. And, you know, I definitely didn't look like a runner, nor ever would have bet that I would be a runner or enjoy running, as I was obese as a child as well. So running was never an option. But, you know, as I started to lose weight and started to become healthy, I looked for an outlet to kind of go over the addiction process that I have. So as I was letting things go, like smoking and drinking, then I looked for something to kind of mend the two. So I remember, I mean, just as probably most people do for me, I remember the first time I ran, I saw my brother-in-law run like a few miles on the treadmill, and I had seen some of my friends, closer friends, do a triathlon. And I was kind of like in the back of my mind thinking, like, you know, could I do something like that? I think at the time I was about 300 pounds, and I was like, you know, could I do something like that? Am I able to? And I remember just deciding one day, you know, like, I want to try. Like, I want to give this, you know, like, running thing a shot. I remember, so funny, I was coming out of our apartment when we lived in downtown Houston, and I told my wife that I was going to go run, and she's a registered dietitian, so she was helping me with my diet. So she was very encouraging. She was, you know, like, go for it, you know. And I remember kind of like putting on the headband and the gear, and I wouldn't run with any of that now, but, you know, like, just being so geared up. And I remember getting out the door and, like, you know, starting, I think I'm at my run or something, and like started, and I made like 20 yards. And I remember just making 20 yards into this parking lot and just being exhausted and just thinking, like, this is the most ridiculous thing ever. Like, I have no clue how people get into this. So slowly but surely, over time, I, you know, like anyone else, 10 yards ended up being 20 yards, ended up being 100 yards. And I, you know, kind of became a runner. And then I started kind of doing a little 5K here and a 10K there. And then we had a challenge between friends to run a half marathon, which I trained for about 6 months and then ended up running this half marathon. And then about 2 weeks after the half marathon, which was in November, I read Born to Run. So unfortunately, I guess, you know, oddly enough, I read Born to Run, and for some reason it just resonated in me. And I read it over a Thanksgiving break where I ran the 10K in Markville with my brother-in-law. And I read it and I just thought, like, I just thought I'm an ultra runner. Like, I just resonated with the story and I was like, this is me. And I remember kind of speaking it out loud, like, I'm an ultra runner. And you know, there's not any one of my friends who ran. You know, it's kind of a weird statement to tell people that, you know, you're an ultra runner and you've never done anything more than a half marathon. But, you know, 5 months later, I was running my first 50 miler.
We've got to find out. I know the number, so I won't spoil it. How much total weight have you lost from your high there?
So I, at my highest ever recorded was 347. At my lowest was 183. So I've lost, percentage-wise, like 49%. Weight-wise, I think it's like 120 70 pounds, and I've pretty much stayed within 10 pounds of that, depending or if I'm trying to gain weight because I choose to lift weights a lot or running a lot, which my weight goes down. So, yeah, about 175 pounds.
Rob, that's amazing. So how long did it take you to make this change? I mean, you're kind of undoing a pretty long lifestyle of some of those other decisions, those other addictions that you talked about. But how long did it take you to complete that transition from, I guess, addicted to the wrong things to, of course, we would say this, addicted to the right things?
For me, January 17, 2011 is when I quit smoking. And the big reason why that was is, in all honesty, my wife, who's my wife now, at the time, I think we were dating. I don't think we were engaged. Maybe we were. But, you know, she kind of just told me, she was in the health field. She was like, if you don't quit smoking, then I'm going to leave. And I quit smoking. And then 2 days later, I started running just because of my personality. And then I became vegetarian over time. And so it was kind of about a four-year period. Probably about a three to four year period of losing the weight. I've kind of, like I said, stayed the same weight for about a year. So it's about a 3 year period of consistent, you know, weight loss all the time.
Was it love at first run, or did it take a while to kind of get you into it?
When you're 300 pounds and you're running, it hurts. And I can remember many of nights, you know, swollen ankles, you know, and I'm going to try to say this as good as well, but chafing between your legs and your butt. I mean, when you're that big and you're running, it's not easy. It's not painful. I mean, it's very painful. It's just not, you know, your body, it takes a lot to get your body to move at 300 pounds.
So you're coming up on the fourth year. How, you know, you've worked up and, did I read correctly? You've done up to a 50 now?
No, I did 107 mile run and, Snowdrop Foundation last year. And I've done some longer distance. I'm not longer than that, so that's the longest I've been.
Wow, that's awesome. So, how has your progression been? Have you been able to stay relatively injury free, or
I have not.
So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you mentioned some of the difficulty of coming from obesity and some of the difficulty of running as a bigger guy. But, you know, once you started to lose the weight, did the injury problems get a little better, or has it still stuck with you a little bit?
So I think, you know, I think the things that hinder me, and I think probably hinder a lot of people, is damage that you can't go back and undo. And for me, you know, about 2 weeks before I ran my first, before I completed my first 50 miler, which was in October of 12, which was the Cactus Rose 50 miler in Bandera, Texas. Before that, you know, months before that, my knees were, my right knee had swollen up and they did MRIs and they, you know, told me that I had torn meniscus in multiple places. And, you know, and the knee doctors at the time said, hey, listen, you know, you've been big for so long, you know, you have all this residual, you know, knee damage. And when I was 350 pounds, one of the things that I used to have to do was, you know, I'd have to stop, you know, two rows into a shopping center, you know, and take a break. And I used to have to lift my legs into my car because my knees hurt so much. So I wasn't surprised that they told me I had knee damage. But at the same time, I was really discouraged because here's this great sport that I've gotten into of running that I really love that's just changed my life. And you're just telling me that, you know, like I'm not built for it because of all these, you know, horrible choices that I made before. So I ran the Cactus Rose 50 miler. A week later, I had meniscus knee surgery. And after I had meniscus knee surgery, which I will tell you did not go well, I've been battling the same knee injury that I've had when I started running, which is, you know, my knee swells. I've had MRIs. Long story short, I just put knee surgery off again 3 days ago. So I really don't want to go back and have knee surgery, although I probably need it. But the knee has always stayed. It swells up. It's incredibly difficult to deal with. And, you know, but I don't try to just lean on that as why I can't do things. I still am able to do things. It's just kind of unfortunate of having to just debate what I want to do and how much pain I want to go through to get there. And I think with a lot of people that lose weight also is that they have loose skin. And that's something I have, you know, and I've debated and talked to my wife and doctors about getting skin removed. But, you know, when you're as big as I am or I was and you get smaller, the skin doesn't go anywhere. So, you know, between your thighs and, you know, underneath your arms and things like that, you know, you have chafing and rubbing. And, you know, I mean, as you get smaller, those are still things that probably the average person doesn't have to worry about or have to deal with.
You've gone the distance. I mean, you've gone over 100 miles, and I think that's kind of a big thing. Once you go 100 miles once, at least for us, it's still a big deal to go the distance, but it doesn't seem as insurmountable as it did. So now that it's not an insurmountable goal that's out there, what do you have on your bucket list that you can go after next?
So I just did Mount St. Helens 50K with my Houston area trail runners, which is the trail running group here in Houston, which I'm the president of. So I just did that, and I ran the Rut Vertical K last weekend. So as of today, I signed up to go do the Vertical K Flagstaff race, which will be on October 4th, which is a Skyrunner race. And then I'm hoping, I'm on the wait list, but I'm hoping to do Javelina 100 in November for my birthday's the 9th. So kind of as a birthday run 100 there with Jamil Curry and the Arrow Viper guys down in Arizona.
Is there any race that's out there that you could just think, hey, I'd really like to do that one day?
You know what's really interesting is that I've been on this kind of thing where I've been hard hiking and trying to do this unsupported trail, which is just north of Houston. It's called the Lone Star Trail, which is the longest contiguous trail in the state of Texas. And without the loops, it's 96 miles. So I attempted it twice in the summer and got knocked on my butt twice. It's the heat got to me around 60-something miles both times, unsupported. And that's really what I want. For some reason, that trail just... it's gnarly and I love it, and it's just calling me back. And every time I tell my friends that I want to go back, or my wife, they're all like, you're a fool. But there's just something about wanting to complete 96 miles unsupported by myself and like get it done that really just kind of irks me down low. So that's my bucket list. I really don't have any other race in my mind until that gets until we get square on that trail.
A lot of us that get into ultra running because we like being out in the woods, we like being out on the trail, really are drawn to that because it's the fun, the enjoyment of that experience without the pressure of it being a race.
And I agree with you 100%. I think when I look at people that do, you know, FKTs, which is something that they have at that trail, and I you know, check the boards and I see people do these incredible 2 or 3 day events and Nolan's 14 and all those races. That really kind of gets me a lot more than, you know, I shouldn't say just any old race, but I think it's just that unique perspective of wanting to kind of go out there and fast pack and then kind of do it on your own or, you know, be supported. So I think those things, like you said, it takes the pressure off. You're out there. I think people that go and do those, they do them for themselves. I think rarely you're going to see somebody willing to go 7 days just to have their name, you know, be the first person, because it'll probably come down as soon as somebody knows that you did it. But it's kind of more of like wanting to experience that. And for me, going through the two attempts that I did has really made me a stronger runner mentally, not necessarily physically or anything else, but mentally, to go through all of that has really made me like kind of, it's made me very humble. It's made me think, you know, like, look at all that you went through in those races and you had nobody around, and coming through those, I really have kind of like found another gear mentally where I'm like, wow, like I can do anything if I can sit out there for 24 hours and suffer on my own.
You took your experience of how ultra running and running helped you kind of turn your life around and have now started to give back to the community through both the Houston area trail runners and the Brazos Bend races. But I guess first, start us off, tell us a little bit about the Houston area trail runners. Did you found that group? Was there not a trail running group there already?
I did. So right after I finished my first ultra, training for my first ultra, I ended up having one of my friends, Jeremy Hansen, and another friend of mine, Jose Quintanilla. These were two of my better friends, but they really weren't trail runners. I mean, none of us were trail runners at the time, but as I trained and went for my first 50, they jumped in as well. My friend Jose finished, my friend Jeremy didn't, but we all ran that race together. And as soon as we finished that race a month later, on my anniversary, a 1 year anniversary wedding, which was December 17th, we decided to start the Houston area trail runners. So there has been running groups in Houston that do trails. So it's not like we were the first here, definitely not. But there really was never, I would say, a club that went about it the way that we wanted to go about it, which is, you know, we wanted to start a club that was USATF, that not only wanted to run, but also wanted to race, which, you know, we run in the Texas Trail Championship. And then also more than that is to give back, meaning give back as volunteer efforts. Like, I'm a Memorial Park volunteer leader, do volunteer days. So it's kind of like, you know, we wanted to have a club where it was kind of everything was included. So if somebody did find us, then we could kind of offer everything that we think would be very, you know, beneficial for people and also for the parks that we run in. So that's how the club got started. And those two gentlemen and my wife made the four that started the group.
So how many members do you have now?
I think I'd look, but I think it's 350 plus or total.
Wow. So it sounds like you guys have found a niche there.
We have. I mean, Houston is being as big as it is. Obviously, it's a metropolitan area. You know, a few years ago, it was, you know, there's no trails in Houston, and there's really was kind of one trail. But then once you start to find places to run, then you obviously, you start to expand the kind of horizon. And then also when you start having people, as I tell my members, we're all pieces to this puzzle. As you start to add pieces to the puzzle, you know, these people have mountain biked on another trail or have run another trail or have experience at another trail. So you end up getting this great community of people from different places that have been more places than one single person. So then all of a sudden you start finding out, hey, you know, Houston has this trail and there's this little rabbit trail that works good and so on and so forth. And then obviously, you know, with time, if we've been able to find trails, and now there's a community of trail runners that is, I should say, demanding trails, which means that, you know, like when Memorial Park, which is our big park, is going through a master planning process, they see that the natural trails, you know, need to be improved or they need to be more trails because there's a demand for it. So, you know, just like supply and demand, you supply, you know, 350 people that want to run trails, and then the people end up, you know, giving you what you want or at least trying to make it accessible for you. So I think that's a big key.
You also started last year the Brazos Bend races. Tell us a little bit about that. You guys have a lot going on with those.
We do. So last year after it was probably around January, maybe it was a little before this, about November, you know, we traveled to every race. Being that we're from Houston, if we're going to go trail race, other than Rocky Raccoon, which is up in Huntsville, it's about an hour away, we have to travel, no matter if it's the Bandera or if it's to, you know, a Captain Carl's race, which is a nighttime series, great, great series as well. We always have to travel to go race. So my thought behind, you know, starting trail running was, number one, I wanted to give back. I wanted to see people get out of trail running what I get out of it, you know, just the sense of accomplishment, you know, everything that's involved in that. And then the other part was, is that I wanted to see my friends run and have their families there and to be able to do more than, you know, three or four runs a year because of, you know, the financial burden of having to travel and having your family. And I know that all too well. So last year we decided around November to contact Brazos Bend State Park, which is a 5,000 acre park. It's about 20 miles south of Houston. Luckily for us, there had been some free races that had been put on there. So the door was kind of cracked open. So when I went in, you know, I kind of told them that I thought, you know, we could get at least, you know, 300 or 400 people to race. And these were my thoughts. And, you know, the park was, encouraged to let us try it, but I know that they never thought that we would bring, you know, 300 people. We ended up having 600 people registered, for a first time trail race. And then that's kind of how it started. And then slowly but surely, you know, after the first of the year, you know, we used our great support system and volunteers you know, my wife and I put the race on in April. And I think 2 days after that race, and, you know, my wife told me that she was wanting to quit her job and do this full time. And then that's kind of where we started the Trail Racing Over Texas, which is now, our umbrella LLC that kind of covers all the races that we'll put on.
Tell us a little bit about the trails there. What are the, you know, what's the terrain like? It looks like you guys advertise it as a flat and fast.
It is. So the park, Brazosbin State Park, is a very, very flat course. I mean, it is, I think it will total half, maybe 500 feet of elevation for a 100-miler. So to say it's flat is almost an understatement. But, you know, as far as terrain, what's known about the park is the wildlife. Most people know that they have gators. That's the big key in April when the gators are out, they cross the path. So people kind of love that. They've never had an incident at the park either. But if I would say that the course is soft ground for probably 20 miles of that, it's wide. So it's normally wide enough trail to get, you know, a small vehicle through for them to move back there. It's also wide enough for horses to pass. So it's pretty wide, pretty flat, and it's fast. We're trying to do everything that we can to make the race as fast as possible, you know, and by doing that, you know, we'll have four loops, 25 miles for the 100 miler. And, you know, we'll have, you know, what normal people would have in Texas. Aid stations kind of vary, I think, on state to state, as I've seen, but our aid stations will stay pretty short. So they'll stay within, you know, 3 or 4 miles of each other. And then that way people can carry as least as possible and try to make the race as fast as possible.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it's set up that way to allow folks to have a pretty easy experience, to not worry about carrying a whole bunch of gear or have really long, difficult sections between aid stations.
It does. And it plays in two great, you know, kind of two parts there. Number one is that it allows us to go into the community, kind of recruit road runners or people that have never run trails before, because it's, you know, not technical and it's not going to be difficult. We're going to be able to get new runners, which is obviously why we had 600 people for the first race or 600 registered for the first race in April. So we want to give people the experience who have never run trails and just get them out into the trail, let them see what it looks like, let them kind of experience what a trail race is going to be like. And then on the flip side of it, for your experienced runners or people that are trying to PR or set course records or maybe even break the 100-mile men and female record, which obviously we're hoping, it gives them an opportunity to know that they're going in, you know, to a park that's going to be wide and flat. And basically all they have to do is, you know, grab a water bottle and then, you know, just run as fast as they can and we'll take care of the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of races out there that kind of pride themselves on the difficulty level, and we like those too, that, you know, there's a place for that. But most folks who are kind of getting introduced to ultra running or just starting at those distances won't, you know, that's not on their level. So I like that you guys have a race that that's beginner friendly for that.
Yeah, and I agree. I just got back from the Rut, you know, which I was probably the greatest trail I've ever seen in regards to mountain running. 40-50% grade and that rock, I mean, it just beat me up even in the vertical K, and it was amazing. But at the same time, I think there's a place, you know, for everything in regards to ultra running, and there's not everyone who wants to run, you know, really hard mountainous trail or something that's super technical. So I think that there's kind of room for everything. And in regards to Houston, and as we go about it, our plan with trail racing over Texas is to kind of expose these great parks. We'll probably use a lot of state parks because we want to encourage people to use the state parks. But, you know, we're going to head out west soon and we're going to get our fair chance to put on a mountain race. So we're going to kind of give everybody a little bit of everything with our race series and not just one thing though.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing how it goes. When is the race again?
The race is going to be December 13th. Of 2014 this year.
And registration is open right now on you guys' website. It's brazosbin100.com. We'll put a link in the show notes as well. But folks can go there to register. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we'll have a 100-miler, a 50-miler, a marathon, and a half marathon, and a relay team. So we kind of put enough for anybody who wants to come out can come out and run, and the registration will be through Ultra Sign Up as well.
Well, that sounds great. We look forward to seeing it. We know some folks who will be out there. So we look forward to seeing how that goes this year.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we're looking forward to having everybody. And as I see people start to sign up from all over the state, I get really excited, not only to see my friends run, but to be able to kind of have people come out and see this really amazing park. And I think people will be really impressed by just how big the park is and how nice it is. It's really kept well.
And also, Rob, thanks so much for sharing your story. I mean, it really is an inspiration to those of us who may not have come even with those as difficult circumstances as those. We haven't fought through some of the difficult things you have, and you've still been able to overcome them. So, it's inspiring, and I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Sure, absolutely. I look at all of us as ultra runners. I see stories of like Rob Graw and Tim Olson and people in my group that have overcome, you know, more than I have, you know, be it that, be cancer or anything else. I mean, we're all supporting each other, and we're all coming from some place to get where we're at. So I think, you know, all of us have really amazing stories of how we got into ultra. So it's always very cool to hear everybody's stories.
I like what they're doing with Brazos Bend in that it's not necessarily going to be the toughest race out there. They're wanting to make something that's approachable and easier for beginners and people who are new to the distance and maybe someone who wants to put out the fastest time possible. I think there's a niche for that. There's plenty of hard races, but I do think there needs to be some of those beginner level races around.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what kind of times are put out there this year and in the future of that event. And I'm also looking forward to seeing what other events that Rob and his wife are able to put together and the variety that they promised.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this go-round. If you have any questions about anything that we talked about in this week's interviews, you can always find those on our show notes at operationultra.com/episode20. And as always, if you have any questions or want to hear back from us, you can always reach us at info@operationultra.com. And of course, don't forget all the social media outlets. We've got Twitter. We're at Operation Ultra. Facebook, facebook.com/operationultra. And again, you can find anything we've talked about on our website. So head over to operationultra.com to take a look at our previous episodes and other stuff we've posted.
And if you haven't already, you can find us on iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. That helps us get the word out about what we're doing. And we look forward to providing you guys with some more interesting interviews and upcoming episodes.
Well, that's it from us.
Happy trails.
And we'll see you next time.